excitement's gone.
Good morning and welcome to Environmental Corner. My name is Julie Villarreal, your host for this half hour. Thank you for joining us today, and today we have a guest. Actually, we have quite a few guests lined up for over the summer, so if I were you, I'd be tuning in and listening. We have John McDougall here with us today, and I've known John for many years. John and I have worked together on Merrimack Valley 2050. He's a professor here. He was in the sociology department. He's now in regional economic and social development. So, John, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having
me on the show. We're here to talk about environment and peace, and then we'll lead on to a new certificate program that John is going to be involved with. So, John, just a little bit background on yourself first.
Oh, well, first of all, mm-hmm. It's always a pleasure to talk to another Scot.
Thank you.
Although I confess I'm a half-breed. My mother is English, so...
yes, your father was from Glasgow, right?
Yes, nonetheless,
and
right.
I'm from Motherwell, which is not too far, just
indeed.
A half-hour train ride from Glasgow. Mm-hmm. So a little bit about yourself, John.
Well, I actually got onto the faculty at UMass Lowell in 1976 and joined mm-hmm. the sociology department, mm-hmm. and I was there until 1996, I guess it was, when we formed this new department that, of course, you know very well, Julie, called mm-hmm. Regional Economic and Social Development. We've sent in to the Guinness Book of World Records for the longest department title. No, I'm kidding.
I actually suggested at one time that they add environment in somewhere there, Department of Regional Economic Environmental and Social Development.
Sure.
I guess that would have made it even...
even worse, right.
even worse than it is. Uh-huh. So then you moved on over there.
Right. I also should mention I've had a pretty strong interest in war and peace issues. Mm-hmm. Really going back to the Reagan years, of course, it's interesting we're discussing this mm-hmm. Just after former President Reagan died. Mm-hmm. And many of us were very concerned at that time when he took office by his very dangerous, in our view, rhetoric. Talking about, well, a limited nuclear war wouldn't be such a problem, and he was building up nuclear weapons in Europe especially, and the saying that they had was that the shorter the range, the deader the Germans, that mm-hmm. There was all of that concern. And so I taught a course called Nuclear Weapons Values in Society, trying to set nuclear weapons in context. Then in 1991, after the Gulf War, several of us organized a major debate involving Noam Chomsky, of course, well-known from MIT, and on the other side of that debate, a gentleman called Scott Thompson, a professor at the Fletcher School at Tufts. And this was about not just the war, but some of the broader issues. And that led us, a group of us, to form what we call PACSI, Peace and Conflict Studies Institute, which is another long acronym. My colleagues there are Professor Dan Egan, now in the Sociology Department, Professor mm-hmm. Bob Gamash from the Environmental, Earth, and Atmospheric Sciences Department here mm-hmm. at UMass Lowell, who, I don't know if you've had him on your show, would be a great person to have on. Mm-hmm. And then finally, Reverend Imogen Stelkin, who I know you know, mm-hmm. who is our Protestant campus minister. And what we've done is a series of educational events. We brought Chomsky back fall of last year. We've had a number of things that we've done that have been more local in scope. And we've worked with a woman that I mentioned when I was on the show with Jim earlier this morning, Barbara Hilt, who's a very interesting youth trainer who tries to help young people, and including our students. She's done some very practical training programs, help young people look at conflict in a more constructive way and find peaceful ways of dealing with interpersonal conflicts, workplace conflicts, school conflicts, and the like. So we've been doing that kind of work. And that led to something that we'll get back to perhaps a little later, which is just over the past 12 months, some colleagues and I have put together a new graduate certificate, which we call Peace and Conflict Resolution Studies at the graduate level. We've already done some training at the undergraduate level. Dan Egan has now taken over an undergraduate minor that we call Peace and Conflict Studies. But now we're doing this work also at the graduate mm-hmm. level.
Before we go on to more about the certificate program and the mm-hmm. class that you're teaching this summer, why don't we sort of try and get the environment and peace, the interface here, so that
sure.
people can understand where you're coming from, how all this relates to the environment and,
sure.
and war and peace.
Okay. Thank you. Right. No, I thought that would be an interesting theme to mm-hmm. to hear about. And it occurs to me there are at least three major areas where I think peace and environment intersect. Mm-hmm. First area is very much on the local scale, this whole issue of environmental injustice, environmental racism, and perhaps you've mm-hmm. had speakers on your program that address that.
Right. Mm-hmm.
For example, as you may know, there was a major report that came out about 12 years ago from the United Church of Christ called Toxic Waste and Race in the United States. The conclusion of that report was that people of color are twice as likely as white people to live in communities that have a commercial hazardous waste facility. People of color are three times as likely to live in a community where there are multiple facilities or a large hazardous waste facility. Mm-hmm. And that situation continues, of course, unabated in the early 21st century.
We've got some of that here locally as well. It's all over the place.
Oh, that's right. In fact, we were talking, and I believe through your center, Center for Family, Work, and Community, you've done some really interesting work on documenting things like the brownfield sites, which are predominantly in poor areas right here in the city of Lowell, and that's true across the country.
Mm-hmm. We have the River Ambassador Program, which is an environmental justice program for youth to be involved in the environmental issues around, and there's all sorts of collaborations going on at the center with
and
the community.
Right. I mean, that's kind of the good news. Mm-hmm. The bad news, obviously, is that these problems continue just a little bit. Downstream from us in the Greater Lawrence area, as you may know, is a concentration of incinerators. In Lawrence, North Andover, Haverhill, which account for about one-third of the total incinerator capacity across the state. And all of those three facilities are located in poorer sections of their various communities, and again, pose a major environmental risk. And what you have here, which is where peace comes in, it seems to me, is a set of problems that can set up major conflicts between the local residents and people in power, in corporations, in city government, in state and federal governments as well. And I'd like to just mention here a very interesting concept that's been developed in the field of peace studies, a concept called structural violence. We hear a lot about what we call overt violence, the war in Iraq, violent crime in poor neighborhoods and so on. We hear that. But structural violence is exemplified by the higher rates of all kinds of, say, cancers that you find in poor neighborhoods. Because obviously that's a violence, that's a suffering that these people, people of color, low-income folks that they encounter, that they have to undergo. And that is caused by, it seems to me, major structures of injustice, of lack of power, lack of economic resources in our society. So that particularly this, as I say, takes the form of local kinds of environmental injustice. So there we have, it seems to me, one very important kind of way in which, on the one hand, environmental problems, public health problems, on the other hand, social injustice and conflict and indeed violence, those two are linked together.
That's very interesting.
Well, thank you. There's a second area of connection, which, of course, we're seeing enormously in the past two or three years, and that is the lack of access to worldwide non-renewable resources, which, of course, is a major force that's driving the war in Iraq. I'm sure we don't need to tell listeners about that. And what I think has become clear is that while a lot of people were saying the Cold War is over, but we have what Samuel Huntington, the Harvard professor, called the clash of civilizations between, say, extreme Muslim fundamentalists and more secular Democrats, small d, in the West. And certainly that has been one of the causes behind tragedies like 9/11. Nevertheless, what we also have is the major powers and other segments of our society globally fighting over scarce resources. And one thing that's striking, there's a really nice book by Michael Clare, a professor at Hampshire College, called Resource Wars, which my students have used and they've liked it a lot. What Clare points out in Resource Wars is that we face, obviously, a huge problem with oil running out, just to take one resource. The estimate is, and I think this goes back to the EPA's, excuse me, Department of Energy's own projections, assuming that world consumption of oil goes up nearly 2% a year, then we're going to completely run out of oil between the years 2040 and 2060. So for some of our younger listeners, that's going to be within their lifetimes. It's an absolutely scary, phenomenal statistic. That is simply extrapolating from current trends. Even if we discover some additional oil in the North Slope of Alaska or wherever, you know, that oil isn't going to add enormously to the amount available. And not only that, but, of course, things like oil in shale form, I believe there are huge amounts of tar sands in Canada, for instance, that oil is harder to get at, and it's more costly to get at. And mm-hmm. the pollution consequences of, say, getting oil from tar shale are much worse than the pollution consequences, say, of pumping the oil out of the ground in Saudi Arabia or Iraq. Mm-hmm. So what we have is this whole problem with an imminent scarcity that we just cannot get around. And what we find is not only that, but the oil that we have left so far is to the extent of about two-thirds of the total proven reserves. The two-thirds of the reserves are located in the Middle East, mm-hmm. particularly Saudi Arabia, Saudi Arabia, Iraq, of course, which is number two, United Arab Emirates, mm-hmm. Kuwait, and Iran, those four countries, particularly Saudi Arabia. Mm-hmm. So you can understand why the Bush administration and previous administrations, the Clinton administration likewise, all these U.S. administrations have made such a big deal of keeping access to oil in the Middle East. It's obviously driven enormously by all of this.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, one other resource to mention, which is also highlighted in Claire's book, I'm glad to see, and that is water.
Mm-hmm.
And you may know the famous saying from Mark Twain that whiskey is for drinking, water is for fighting, which unfortunately has become a very limited resource around the world, and particularly, mm-hmm. of course, in some of the desert areas of the Middle East and Central mm-hmm. Asia. One statistic I discovered this morning, taking yet another conflict, which mm-hmm. is driven in part by resources, mm-hmm. other things as well, that is the Israel-Palestinian conflict. The average Israeli consumes about four times as much water as the average Palestinian in the occupied territories. Mm-hmm. And so you have a conflict which has these other sources, but very much has also the source that is that there is this limited environmental, very mm-hmm. sensitive mm-hmm. resource, and people just don't have access to it.
Wow.
And one other thing I thought I'd mention here is that one thing that adds to all of these problems is that constructive alternatives, the kinds of things that I'm sure many of your guests have discussed to deal with environmental problems,
mm-hmm.
those alternatives, like solar energy, like educating folks so that you don't have environmental pollution right here in Lowell, and you were telling me about the Healthy Homes program mm-hmm. that you're doing here in Lowell. All those things cost money.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Sure, they involve volunteer effort, like you, our gracious mm-hmm. hostess, who volunteer your time on the show. But at some point, people have to be paid. You have to buy materials and so on.
Right.
Well,
yes, we do.
How do we pay for those? It's the federal government, of course, in this country is a major funder of all of these things.
Mm-hmm.
And the federal government now, of course, has far and away the biggest military budget in the world, currently spending at the tune of $400 billion a year. And there's a really nice little gimmick I got, this pin from an organization called True Majority. Folks like
TrueMajority.org,
That's right, TrueMajority.org.
And you get this really neat pen with a little thing you can pull out that's got all these numbers, statistics.
Yes. Exactly, it's a sneaky pen.
Yes, tell us some of them, John.
Okay, one of the things it mentions is that the federal budget, as I've mentioned, for defense, the so-called the Pentagon budget, runs to about $400 billion a year.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you contrast that with the so-called axis of evil countries that we used to hear mm-hmm. about, Iraq, North Korea, Iran.
Mm-hmm.
You add up their military budget, comes to $7 billion.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, about 2.5% of the total U.S. military budget, all these bad guys combined.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we have to have some sense of the immensity of the military budget. And by the way, this does not include the ongoing war in Iraq. As you know, we're talking about another $25-50 billion that will be requested for the next fiscal year. So far, for this past fiscal year, the war in Iraq has cost us $66 billion, the total war on terrorism, $87 billion. So huge amounts of money go into all of these things. By contrast, one thing I discovered from, again, True Majority, is that to achieve energy independence, you know, something that we're mm-hmm. hearing a lot about as an alternative to fighting wars in Iraq and so on, that would cost the U.S. about $10 billion a year.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, contrast that with $400 off the defense budget. So you just chip off a mere $10
billion. Mm-hmm.
You're left with still $390, which is no small amount.
Mm-hmm.
And you could invest in energy independence for this country, obviously a major environmental concern that no doubt many of your other speakers have addressed over the years mm-hmm. on this show.
Mm-hmm.
So, as I say, I think there are all kinds of major connections between the fight for these scarce resources and the militarization of that fight on the one hand, and on the other hand, our inability to deal with really serious environmental problems.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Finally, I thought I'd mention that I think there's some deeper kind of issues about our culture and how we look at the environment and at nature.
Right. And yeah, you were talking about loss of species diversity and things like that.
Something I looked up this morning, mm-hmm. which shocked me. I read about it but forgotten about it. Biodiversity. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if mm-hmm. you've had speakers about that topic on this show. The very famous Harvard professor Edward Wilson, who has really put the issue of biodiversity on the map, he projects that if we continue the way we're going, then by the end of this century, a half of all the species in the planet will disappear. You know, animals, plants, insects, and so on.
Mm.
Another really grim prospect. I don't want to be just a prophet of doom and gloom this morning with you folks, but I think it's something we absolutely have to look at. And I think, you know, one way to look at that is to say, well, World War II, in the case of the Soviet Union, killed about 10% of their population, 20 million out of a population of around 200.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that was an enormous tragedy. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I was lucky enough to go to the Soviet Union about 15 years ago and would meet people even now hobbling around with legs amputated because they'd lost them in World War II.
Mm-hmm.
And of course,
mm-hmm.
millions of people lost family members in that war. So we're talking about one-tenth of that human population in that huge tragedy. Contrast that with what Wilson is saying about half of all species. And of course, that could, in all likelihood, mean the real collapse of the global ecosystem, you
right.
know, huge environmental
right.
problems.
Right.
Now,
mm-hmm.
how do we get there? How do we come to face that prospect? Well, some of the things I've mentioned earlier are mm-hmm. clearly reasons for it, but I think there's also a cultural factor going on. I think people just don't know about that, except for wonderful shows like this, where this kind of information can be brought to the public.
Yeah, because we always bring things
media.
That you don't normally hear on the radio and in the newspapers.
Right. Thank you for doing that. Yeah, you're doing a great public service. And I think what we see in our culture is an attitude that humans come first and other living beings come second
right.
or 15th,
right.
you know.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, around here in Greater Lowell, for somebody like myself, I guess you too, Julie, mm-hmm. you know, who commute from some of the suburbs
mm-hmm.
into Lowell,
mm-hmm.
you know, we don't intend it that way, but in a subtle way, perhaps because we live in the suburbs and drive all over the place and
mm-hmm.
are part of suburban sprawl. You know, obviously sprawl, which has now, thank goodness, been identified as a major environmental threat
right.
and is causing the loss of habitat for all kinds of species right here in Massachusetts, not just around the planet. Another, I think, problem with our way of thinking is how we lack information. And one of the things in our Merrimack Valley 2050 group that you and I worked with a few years ago mm-hmm. is indicators of sustainability.
Right.
And my colleague Maureen Hart, who is a real expert on this, who lives close by in North Andover, she says that we are what we measure.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to ask ourselves, how do we measure, you know, where our society is going, where our economy is going? And, of course, the standard measure is gross national product, which
right.
I have to say is rightly
right.
named gross. I think it's kind of yucky in some ways. But that doesn't take into consideration environmental pollution.
No,
it doesn't
no,
take,
no.
And it doesn't take into consideration social injustice.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
In fact, when a company causes a pollution problem and then goes and cleans it up,
mm-hmm.
spends money, hires people to clean it up, gross national product goes up because more people have been hired to clean up the mess. But
right.
what if the mess hadn't been
right.
created in the first place?
Right.
So it seems to me that
it's a sort of end of pipe sort of way that they look at things. They
right.
clean it up after they've done their...
Right. And that looks like economic progress as
right.
it's conventionally measured,
right.
even
right.
though from an environmental and frequently social justice standpoint and peace standpoint,
mm-hmm.
it's anything but.
Mm-hmm.
It's a real problem.
Mm-hmm. You're right.
Mm-hmm. So I think we have to switch to a very different way of looking at things. We have
mm-hmm.
to look at us humans as living in harmony with nature.
Right.
And we're just one
more.
Species among maybe 30 million
yes.
that we have on the planet.
Yes.
Also, some social scientists, particularly, I'm blanking out on the name, Paul Hawken, H-A-W-K-E-N,
mm-hmm.
has
mm-hmm.
written very thoughtfully about what he calls natural capital, which, of course, we're eating up natural
yes.
capital. You know, we're using up aquifer water, for example, non-renewable
right.
resources of any kind.
Right.
So we have to get back to renewing that. But there's also social capital. There's
right.
this nice book
yes.
called Bowling Alone that you may have heard about by
Bowling
Robert
Alone.
Putnam, P-U-T-N-A-M. And we need to get back to building up our social capital. Well, what is social capital? In a sense, social capital means societies and communities where people really join in. Like you mentioned, the River Ambassadors program. That's a fabulous program to get the youth here in Lowell really contributing not just to having a clean river, but their families becoming aware of environmental issues.
Yes, and they go home and they spread the word, you see, to their parents, their grandparents, and then they become aware of all the issues.
Right, so, and they're not just spreading the word, alas, you know, my friend got killed in a gang shootout.
No, they're doing things about it.
They're doing things about it, right. About it.
And educating at the same time.
In fact,
time.
We had a great show in the Peace Institute with a show from the folks in the Ribbon Ambassadors program. I had a great time, one of the most enjoyable things I've done, because I just sat around and watched this great show.
They had a great group.
And it seems to me if you have social capital, you have really viable communities and real participation in politics, not just voting every four Novembers, but people actively involved in discussions about major issues and really shaping decisions. If you have all of that, you really have a what we call in the field positive peace, constructive set of relationships around your community, in your workplace, in your school, and of course also constructive relationships with the environment, with the ecosystem.
Right.
It takes a while to build that, but I think we have to change our culture. And one thing I found has been a real delight in my teaching career at UMass Lowell is I've done a lot with placing students, mostly undergrads, in various organizations that are doing constructive work. In fact, I think I had, didn't I, one or two students you've had at the center with your composting work and others, Julie, you know, who have got course credit by looking at some of these constructive things and getting actively involved. Because I think often we change our attitudes, we change our view of the world, not just by reading, not just by hearing people, but actually getting our hands literally dirty.
Dirty, yes.
You know all about that, changing the worms at the bins here at school. And, you know, I think that's really what, you know, how we can create a more peaceful world as well as a more environmentally sustainable world. So hopefully I've made, you know, some of these linkages, the ecological environmental justice, the resource wars, and then finally the kind of cultural change and the cultural disjuncture between the mainstream culture and what I think we need to build up.
This has been great, John, because now I'm really psyched because I'm actually one of the ones signed up for your new piece. And conflict resolution certificate program that's going to be starting in the fall, which we can maybe talk about now in the last couple of minutes, because this the way you've explained it makes really good makes sense.
Oh, thank you.
Now I'm sort of psyched about maybe taking this and going on. And
because we're going to use you as a guinea pig.
I know
I'm going to
be the guinea pig.
Right.
Oh my God. Let's talk a little bit about your certificate program that's starting up in the fall.
Okay, the way we've set it up is there are five courses people have to take. Normally in a graduate certificate at UMass Lowell, it's only four, but we have five. The reason is there are four courses on substantive material that people, there are some electives, there are two electives, a bunch of electives, I'm sorry, you choose two, and then there are two required courses.
Two required,
But beyond that, we have a practical experience requirement because we feel it's absolutely crucial that people really roll up their sleeves and learn some skills.
Well, I think the hands-on experience will be very valuable. I'm going to be really looking into that this summer about where I'm going to be doing my my work study.
Great. Well, we look forward to working with you on that. What we're thinking is the hands-on experience will take a variety of, there'll be a variety of possibilities. For instance, somebody might be interested in human rights and may get involved in an advocacy organization. Or they may want to pick up some quite specific skills in mediation. Or in what the Harvard Negotiation Project calls constructive, excuse me, principled negotiation. So my co-worker, who Julie and I know very well, Dave Turcotte, has been trained as a mediator. Or Barbara Hilt, who I mentioned we've been working with, is really good at training youth in constructive ways of dealing with conflict. So there may be some more sort of small-scale kinds of things, or people may get involved in advocacy in the field experience course.
Let's give out some contact info, John, before we run out of time, just so that people, they can always call me, Julie Villarreal, at the Center for Family Work and Community at 978-934-4772, and I can always put you in touch with John or Dave Turcotte. So let's give out some other info that you might want people to know. That you, they can visit the website,
Yes. That's www.uml.edu/DEPT, which is department, slash RESD, RESD, that horrible acronym, slash peace. That gets us onto that.
All right.
And my email address is john, J-O-H-N underscore, macdougall at uml.edu. Or you can call me at 934-4303.
I have some of these little brochures, John, at the center that people can walk in. We're located at the Wanna Lancet Mill Building, 600 Suffolk Street, if they want to walk in and talk to Dave. Dave is located there, too.
Right.
I hope you get lots of students
Thank
for this.
Thank you. Can I also mention before we close,
yes, this is a summer
I'm teaching
course.
A course this coming summer, the second session, and I'd love to have folks sign up. It's graduate only, unfortunately, which means anybody with a college degree, no matter what their major was, can take the class. We start on July the 13th, and we go through August the 19th, July 13th, August 19th. The course is called Social Movements and Empowerment. And what we do is try to understand the dynamics of grassroots activism. And the issues can be obviously environmental, but also things like labor, gender, peace, and so on.
Right.
One of the options in the course is for people to get involved in actual practical hands-on activism on some of these issues. And having done that, they will then fulfill one of the requirements in the course. And I'd be delighted to work with people who have a whole variety of interests. And hopefully they can not only get some skills, but do things that are badly needed in some local environmental piece or whatever group.
Right.
Also, this course does count towards our certificate.
There you go.
Right, there we go. So
I've
you're on your way.
I've actually taken that class, John, as an undergraduate with Mitra's Ass.
Oh, right. Another very professor,
many years
colleague
ago,
of mine.
Yes.
Right.
So there you go. If you want to do that class, then you get signed up. You're on your way to the certificate program.
Right.
I think we have to wrap up now, unfortunately, John. We want to thank you for coming on the show. Thank you for explaining this relationship between the environment and the war and everything. And hopefully you will get lots of people to sign up for your class.
Certainly hope so. I'm looking forward to it.
Well, I'm already signed up for the certificate program, and I'm looking forward to doing it.
Well, I'm looking forward to working with you in
yes,
yet
I'll
another capacity.
Yes, I'll finally have John
McDiggle
for as my instructor. I've known John for, like, what, 10 years?
Finally made a bad decision, Julie.
I made
no,
a
I'm
bad
kidding.
Decision.
Right.
No, so we thank you for taking the time to come on the show.
Thank you.
Next week.
Oh, thank you so much, Julie, for having me.
You're welcome. Listen in next week. I don't know who the guest is going to be, but we will certainly have some interesting information for you. Thank you.
WUML Lowell.
This neighborhood is blighted. That's what people say. Half the buildings are abandoned. Everything is gray. Half the kids have eyes because of the sewage plants nearby. And the mayor doesn't seem to care if we live or die.